Objects in the mirror are closer than they appear.
Does it still say that on?
I think it has to. I think it's a. I feel like it's a law. I haven't looked.
You wouldn't see it, but you wouldn't see it.
Dollars to donuts. That was the result of a lawsuit, and a law got passed that said they had to do it.
Yeah. All I ever think about relevance-wise is that scene in Jurassic Park where the dinosaur gets really close to biting the mirror off, and it says objects in mirror, et cetera, et cetera.
It's a classic. But I guess it felt like a riddle to me. Like, I couldn't wrap my head around what the hell it meant. It felt like a lot of wordplay for, like, a nine-year-old.
And you feel like of all the times to be really clear about your intentions, when you're talking about some basic automotive driving principles, that's when you really want to make sure that that message makes sense rather than, well, riddles, you know.
Yeah, wait a second. Why does it have to be that way?
I think it's to get more of the image in there.
Oh, because it's like curved, maybe? It's like there's a convex or concave?
Convex.
Convex.
Concave. Think about cave. A cave is something you walk into, so that's tucked inward. Convex.
Thank you.
You're vexed at how tall the mountain is. No, I don't know.
Journos, a stream of consciousness news podcast with Stephen Jackson and Brandon R. Reynolds.
The conversation we just had reminded me of a recent situation over in the United Kingdom where things in reality were not what they appeared to be.
And, you know, that makes me think of things in reality that are really real. And one of those things is this show, which is Journos. I'm Brandon R. Reynolds.
I'm Stephen Jackson.
Thank you. Journos, Stephen, is a show in which we take a very dumb story and a very smart story, and we break them down. We analyze them. We figure out how close they are to the mirror of our minds.
It's a show where we prove that two stories are actually, in fact, closer than they appear to be.
There you go. There you go. You were saying?
I was saying that recently in the UK, there was a scenario where something in reality was not what it was billed to be. And you may have heard of this recently, but it was a Willy Wonka experience that the news media has had a field day with. Long story short is that there was a company that developed one of these immersive movie-themed experiences that you can kind of walk through and experience the world of, you know, Willy Wonka, the new Willy Wonka film. This Willy Wonka experience turned out to be such a disaster. It turned out to be so much the opposite of what it was billed to be that the immediate comparison was to the Fire Festival. Oh, so, of course, Fire Festival, you're going to read about that because, boy, what a time that was.
We're unwrapping the drama behind the Willy Wonka-inspired experience in Scotland. Willy's chocolate experience may have sounded like a golden ticket opportunity at first, but in reality, it was anything but sweet. Attendees at this Willy Wonka-inspired pop-up in Glasgow, Scotland, were promised via its website that guests could, quote, marvel at extraordinary props, oversized lollipops, and a paradise of sweet treats. But guests say it was not at all what they had been promised.
AI is, of course, involved. The images of the event that were billed as actual images of the experience itself were, in fact, generated by AI. So when families lugged their kids out to essentially an abandoned warehouse is in Glasgow. The families, when they got there, it was just this like derelict hellscape with like plastic chairs and like weird ribbons and shit sort of strewn about.
Just a warehouse. Some of those pole and curtain things, just some black curtains kind of look like, you know, an emergency triage center after a disaster. Like, well, somebody's back there getting a blood transfusion. Yeah. I would say that depending on your relationship with the whole Wonka franchise, and if you were a child who grew up with the Gene Wilder original, I would say that this experience was successful in that it captured the uncanniness and the horror aspect of it without any of the fun and a lot less color.
There was like a lot of awful shit that happened in that film. Nothing was what it seemed in this magical wonderland of the Willy Wonka experience. The actors that were paid were given scripts that were apparently, quote, 15 pages of AI-generated gibberish. They made up a random villain called the Unknown, who was a, quote, evil chocolate maker who lives in the walls. And there was no chocolate at the end of the tour. Kids were given a single jelly bean. and a cup of lemonade.
Mm-hmm. The real treat, Stephen, is the treat that was given to the headline writers who wrote, amongst other things, Chocolate Fire Festival inside the Willy Wonka event that had infuriated guests calling the cops. That's Entertainment Weekly.
Yeah.
Exquisitely Bad Willy Wonka Experiences Fire Fest for Kids.
Mm-hmm.
And my personal favorite, Willy Wonka Experience actor speaks out about event that left him crying in his car.
There's a picture of an Oompa Loompa in what looks like a meth lab. There's like these weird rainbow structures. It's so bleak and it's so funny.
It's kind of the opposite of feng shui, right? Like where there are items placed so as to make energy flow in a certain way. There's an item like a statue of a giant bag of candy that's placed in just such a way that it somehow makes the room look more empty and desolate. It would have been better if they'd had nothing there, and then at least you could use your imagination. Unfortunately, too, that statue is right next to a folding table, and on the table is just some scattered clear plastic cups full of yellow liquid. So it just looks like a bunch of people left urine samples and quickly ran away.
Everything is kind of cordoned off by, as you said, these like nylon barricades that looks like you're basically about to get a vaccine.
So against all evidence, there was an organizer of this thing. It was called the House of Illuminati, which do with that what you will, which apparently is an immersive events company. And the organizer, a guy named Billy Cool, told a news station, quote, "I'm really shocked that the event had fallen short of the expectations of people on paper. My vision of the artistic rendition of a well-known book didn't come to fruition. For that, Stephen," and he actually says Stephen in here for some reason, "for that, I am absolutely, truly, and utterly sorry." And I think that really says it all. On the surface, this doesn't seem like it's news.
But this, of course, was news because of the existence of the Firefest, which has become this folklore of greed for events and hype and promising something that you can't deliver on, but you know, you still go through with it.
It was billed as a lavish, one-of-a-kind music festival for an elite millennial crowd, with weekend ticket packages running from $1,500 to $12,000. But this morning, the organizers of the failed Fire Festival are feeling the heat.
We had no electricity, there was no showers, there's no bathrooms, there's no like running water.
The actual experience exceeds all expectations.
The expectation, luxurious accommodations. The reality, more like a disaster relief campsite.
Yeah, it's sort of like an infection, right? Like the Fire Festival was this infection that happened to the culture. And when it happened, it sort of created these antibodies, right? Like the immune response of the culture was, whenever something like this pops up, we're all going to swarm over it. So something that, in the absence of the Fire Festival, this Willy Wonka experience would never have been noted. But because it was there, we're all now extra sensitive to events that, you know, have some of the hallmarks of this. The difference is, as you said, it's kids. One of the big differences from the Fire Festival was the sense of hubris, right? Because so many people were like influencers, people who thought of themselves as big shots, and then they were just stranded and left to die on a beach. And we all sort of...
Which is wonderful.
We enjoyed that. And you have the...
Schadenfreude.
For sure. In this case, there's not a whole lot to say because it really is just like, well, it's an empty warehouse and a thing that didn't go over well.
Yeah.
But it reminds us to check in with the idea of the existence of these kind of con artists, which is sort of what Wonka was anyway. I mean, he was...
Definitely.
I mean, he did have an actual chocolate factory.
You know, you could read it a lot of ways. Some people would see him as a self-made man, you know, who was trying to just run his business without the government meddling in all of his goddamn affairs.
Yeah, that's very true. Yeah, it is.
Right?
Yeah, as far as I know, and again, this is Scotland, so I don't know all about their laws, but I'm not sure if there are any laws on the books that protect kids from fantasy disappointment of this type. But, you know, maybe there should, and maybe that is a discussion that will happen now. But I will say that protecting kids via regulation is certainly something that has been in the media a lot lately. Some very big stories, Stephen, concerning your friend and mine, the internet.
Ah, internet. Yeah. Gives so much and asks so little.
I would argue that it asks a lot and more. But no, that is sort of part of what's going on right now. There are, Stephen, two cases, one from Texas, one from Florida. And both of these cases center around social media companies pulling what Texas and Florida would say are conservative voices, conservative opinions, censoring those from places like Facebook, Twitter, et cetera, et cetera. And so now this has proceeded to the Supreme Court, where essentially the states are asking the Supreme Court to allow them to control what these social media companies can and can't say. Or to put it another way, to keep these social media companies from controlling their own content, from deciding what they can filter out, what they can keep in, whatever.
Yeah.
Which is a huge, huge deal. I mean, the argument from Texas and Florida is, we think this is censorship and we want to promote free speech. The response is companies should be able to filter out hateful content and all these different things. And this all came out of the January 6th attack on the Capitol, the coup, some call it. And social media sites booted Trump because they were afraid that his posts were going to produce more unrest and, you know, you would have a problem that would start to spread.
Yeah.
And so that has been picked up by the GOP and the right-wing media as, oh, look, big tech is anti-conservative voices. They're trying to shut us down. We have to now do a thing that seems like, for a party that's dedicated to small government and the ascension of business, seems really weird. It's like, well, we want the state to control what businesses can do. So we're definitely kind of through the looking glass a little bit here, but then maybe we have been for a while.
Specifically, what's happening in the Supreme Court right now has to do with Section 230 of a law that was passed back in the 90s called the Communications Decency Act. What it does, this whole situation brings us to the nexus of the free speech argument in a lot of ways, because the conservative leaders from these two states are claiming that these social media companies are restricting their freedom of speech. Of course, on the other end of it, the social media companies are saying that by refusing to allow them to regulate their own content, they in fact are restricting their right to free speech. Yeah. Because part of that would be to decide what you don't wish to publish on your platform, which brings immediately into focus kind of the nuance of all of the free speech laws.
You know, Stephen, to show our work a little bit here, when we were talking about what are we going to do on this episode, the idea of Section 230 came up. And what made it appealing to us was that, you know, we're living in these very polarized times where, you know, everything is a knee-jerk reaction. You have this strong feeling about this or that, you know, guns, abortion, drugs, homelessness, all of these things. And so much of the impulse now is for us to go immediately to one side or the other, left or right, which in part is driven by the effect of over a decade of social media algorithms. But, you know, the more we talked about 230, the more we realized, like, it's hard to really understand it because it's big and because its effects are so various. It doesn't break down one way or the other. If you're left or right, there's something to love and something to hate about it either way. So the goal for us today was to sort of break down what it's about, where it came from, what it does well, what it does poorly, and, you know, where the state of the conversation is now, so that you and I, Stephen, smart people in some ways, but very dumb in others, could get a sense of, you know, where do we stand on it? I mean, even I, you know, I'm not even sure, and I've written about it, I'm not even sure where I stand on it now.
Yeah, me neither. And I think that's also okay. Talk about showing your work. It's okay to, like, not come away with a specific conclusion to a question this big, or maybe not have to, like, die on some hill just because it represents some part of, you know, your political identity, right? Which, of course, has a lot to do with free speech. But in order to kind of contextualize some of this, we got to go way back, almost 30 years back. I can't believe it's that long ago. 1996, there was the Communications Decency Act. This was signed by President Bill Clinton, Slick Willie,
But true.
That was the thing. So basically, the CDA imposed criminal sanctions on people or entities that would knowingly send minors obscene pictures or videos or images, right? And so this was really happening in the early, not the technical early days of the internet, but really that late 90s stage of the internet where no one knew what the heck was really happening. But suddenly a lot of crazy stuff was happening and there was truly no regulations around it.
A lot of porn was showing up in places that nowadays we think, well, maybe now it's coming more back. But there was a lot of it running around then. And so people were worried, like, kids are definitely going to see this. And this is not great.
Yeah. And it was so new that there were legitimate concerns about, you know, people grooming kids in chat rooms. And, you know, it was such a Wild West atmosphere. Again, this is one of those things where maybe the intention of that law wasn't entirely all bad.
On the surface, you say, well, right, we want to keep indecent stuff from the kids. But of course, politicians like nothing more than to tuck their pet projects into big legislation. So what happened was a guy named Henry Hyde, a representative from Illinois who was a Republican and an opponent of abortion, slid some language into the bill that would kind of prevent people from spreading information about abortion. And then he said, no, this wasn't about that at all. But it was enough to freak people out, right? It was enough to make people think, oh, this is now becoming something that's really going to restrict speech. So that's where the conversation about how do we control this bill started to really take off. And a lot of this is captured in a story, Stephen, that you sent me from the New York Times from the distant year of 1996, when, again, it's important to remember that the internet was a new thing. And so it's really fun to read this and to hear the way they use the language. So, for example, quote, but opponents say the provision known as the Communications Decency Act goes too far by placing unconstitutional restrictions on speech over the global computer network known as the internet, including an apparent ban on discussions of abortion issues on public computer networks. Already, in what appears to be the largest organized protest on the internet, hundreds of computer screens on the World Wide Web, the popular internet service, have protested the act by switching to black backgrounds. Quote, 1,000 points of darkness, one protester called it. Hundreds more are expected to do so today. That's multiple hundreds of internet users, Stephen, in protest.
Yeah. 1,000 points of darkness. That's like they're making fun of the Bush thing. Wasn't his whole thing 1,000 points
of
light?
Yeah, that was the first Bush. 1,000 points of light. That's right. Yeah. Bush. So we're really reaching back into some of the great memes of the 90s.
We're getting back there. You know what? And that's what the kids want to hear on this show. Mm. But so 230 is this section of the Communications Decency Act that was tacked on there that essentially protects internet service providers and internet companies from being prosecuted for user-generated content that appears on their site. But then at the same time, it gives them the freedom to remove content that they deem to be harmful or incendiary or, you know, pornographic or whatever. So a year after the CDA is passed, there was a challenge to it, Reno versus the ACLU, in which the CDA was largely struck down. However, Section 230 remained. And the significance of it remaining as part of the law of the land cannot really be understated. I mean, people go so far as to say the internet would not be what it is today without the provisions granted by Section 230.
Yeah, so it comes out of a couple of lawsuits in which companies sue internet service providers for comments that are made about those companies in like the bulletin boards. Things that, you know, in one case, a company was called fraudulent and that sort of thing. So the idea that like this service provider is hosting bad messages about these other guys and, you know, and that shouldn't be allowed. And so in response to that, Oregon representative, who's now Senator Ron Wyden, and Representative Chris Cox created this amendment to the CDA that said, quote, interactive computer services were not responsible for what their users posted. Here's what Wyden, who is, again, a big promoter of, you know, civil liberties, and he's against surveillance. He's very pro-privacy. So he's been an internet guy from the beginning. Here's what he told Vox in 2019. What I was struck by then, meaning in 1996, is that if somebody owned a website or a blog, they could be held personally liable for something posted on their site. And I said then, and it's the heart of my concern now, if that's the case, it'll kill the little guy, the startup, the inventor, the person who is essential for a competitive marketplace. It'll kill them in the crib. And so they came up with 230, which, as you said, kind of has two provisions. Basically, a sword and a shield. The shield is that these companies are protected from liability for things that are posted by third parties on their site. So if you have a comment on something, you're not going to be held liable. And the sword part is that they essentially have the ability to moderate their own content. And those are the kind of two key provisions of 230, which caused a lot of the good of 230, but also have engendered a lot of the subsequent problems. None of which you could really see at the time, but a lot of that has obviously come out subsequently.
So in court, there's two laws, right? There's a Texas law and there's a Florida law. There's a Texas law in the books that prohibits social media platforms with at least 50 million active users from blocking, removing, or demonetizing content based on users' viewpoints, right? It's basically to prevent what the Texas legislature would view as censorship, Okay. And in Florida, the legislation prevents social media companies from banning political candidates and, quote, journalistic enterprises. And that law is all about not preventing certain political speech to be censored. Now, of course, these laws were created with conservative viewpoints and values in mind. And of course, you're going to go after the platform that is trying to take that message down. So we get into that subjectivity area, which gets really, really murky. And I think it's really interesting that for the conservatives, you're using this free speech argument to really impinge upon the free speech of another entity. And of course, that's where we also, where I find myself really confused. I'm like, am I siding with the social media companies on this one? I'll tell you who does. A lot of people who you would think are certainly not on the conservative side of things, ACLU, the EFF.
Yeah. People who have been critical of tech companies and really paid attention to the kind of things they've done in the past. This is where you see, like you say, the confusion over which side am I on here? And now it's between tech companies, which caused a lot of problems. Their algorithms have created greater polarization, distributed disinformation. You know, there have been studies that have shown that it's feeding content to kids that's, you know, increasing depression, anxiety,
making money off our data.
All of which, by the way, Section 230 made possible because it said you have free rein to produce that content. And basically, social media companies want to be able to control what they publish and not be held liable for content that's harmful, right? Especially, Stephen, that content that drives outrage and therefore creates longer engagement and therefore is the most profitable. So that's what you're unfortunately, that's what you're sort of defending when you...
Defending, yeah. And that's what's weird. And I think, what does an internet without Section 230 look like?
No internet at all. It doesn't look like anything. It wouldn't happen.
Basically no internet. And why is that?
It goes back to what Ron Wyden was saying in the beginning when he drafted the law, which is you need something that creates in this blank tapestry, this empty warehouse of the early internet, the opportunity to start businesses, to innovate, to try new things. And if there's too much risk involved in like holding you responsible if somebody on one of your platforms says something crazy, then people aren't going to be incentivized to invest. And so it's just going to die on the vine. It's going to look, Stephen, sort of like a half-baked or quarter-baked or maybe 10th-baked Willy Wonka experience somewhere in Scotland. I won't say where.
Yeah.
But that's the problem. And so it flourished in part because there was this sort of delicate, though imperfect, balance between something that allows them to do what they want with impunity, but there are still basic regulations prohibiting like things that are federally protected. You know, you can't like the equivalent of yell fire in a theater. Like those things are still not protected in there. So there were some controls. But by and large, it was a little bit of a Wild West. And now we're seeing 30 years later, the problems that's caused, which, you know, again, like the polarization and the disinformation and anxiety and all of those things.
So the only remaining element of this law that, you know, I think generally speaking is, as you said, the sword that social media companies do have to keep just like crazy child pornography and all that stuff off of their sites. That's this thing that in the name of elevating the voice of a conservative or a conservative viewpoint, they're willing to throw out the window.
Yeah.
And that's kind of crazy, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're going to say, as the three most conservative justices did in early arguments, this is Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito, and Neil Gorsuch. The three of them seemed more sympathetic to the state's arguments. This is per the New York Times. Quote, all three said phrases like content moderation were euphemisms for censorship. So they're arguing that, you know, there should be this sort of unrestricted space. So you find yourself in this weird situation where if you're looking at the behavior of conservatives from the beginning of the law to now, in the early days, conservatives were in favor of restrictions to keep pornographic content aimed at kids off of the internet. But now here they are saying we need fewer controls. And the response from the tech companies is, if we have that, then we can't keep pornographic content aimed at kids off of the platforms. So this is what, again, makes it so hard to sort of track your feelings about it.
Well, yeah. Is the social media company engaging in censorship for making a judgment call about what to take down?
I mean, I think that there's a lot of argument about it. But at the end of the day, as many people have said a lot of times, social media companies are businesses. And businesses have the right to make rules. Like, a restaurant can say, you have to wear a shirt when you come into the restaurant. That's not infringing on someone's First Amendment right. That's the rules of the restaurant.
That happened to us when we went out to dinner the other night. And you were like, and I was like, Brandon, dude, we've talked about this.
And you're said, like, whatever. Supreme Court, Stephen, Supreme Court.
Happened?
And I walked in there because I wanted to show off my new tramp stamp, which superseded my old tramp stamp.
It's the snake cut up into little pieces.
I felt like everyone at that Arby's should see what I had going on. And I felt like the reaction was not as enthusiastic as I wanted, but certainly was loud. So, you know, firm but fair.
Firm but fair.
Yeah. You know, and you can track the progression of this law, the twists and turns of it. It always sort of comes back around. I mean, in this case, it's very focused on like conservative voices. But historically, the twists and turns have been around children and around particularly sex-based content. You know, so like Section 230 has, from its birth, been a controversial subject that people have tried to amend, tried to fix, tried to, you know, get ahead of some of the problems that we've talked about today and certainly in previous episodes that the internet itself and social media companies and big tech have unleashed upon us. So just as one example, in 2018, there were two bills that were proposed to amend Section 230. One was called the Allow States and Victims to Fight Online Sex Trafficking Act, or FOSTA, and the Stop Enabling Sex Traffickers Act, SESTA. Both of those were signed into law, and they changed 230 by holding these platforms responsible for like prostitution ads that were posted, you know, by third parties, which in theory was supposed to make it easier for the police and federal authorities to go after sex trafficking websites. And so it amended 230 in this way. But it didn't really work. And civil libertarian groups at the time were saying, no, this is not going to work. It's going to, on the one hand, just make websites more cautious about the content they post, which again will restrict the natural culture and commerce on the internet. And on the other hand, it will make things more dangerous for sex workers who now have to become more secretive, and therefore that makes their jobs more dangerous. And turned out that's exactly what happened after the law was passed in April 2018. A bunch of websites removed whole sections that had nothing to do with sex or sex trafficking or anything. And then sex workers said they started having to work on the streets again because they didn't have the internet to handle their business and act as a filter between themselves and potential customers or threats. So, you know, if there's a shorthand to all this, it's that we're always trying to balance freedom with privacy, right? You want to be able to do what you want on the internet, but you also want to be able to do it safely, privately, whatever. And so, you know, will a proposed amendment to Section 230, quote, protect kids on the one hand, but prevent companies from doing encryption so that, you know, federal authorities can see emails and be able to more easily investigate potential sex trafficking? So people on the privacy side say, no, this is really bad. That's the kind of conflicts you get into when you're dealing with these proposed amendments to Section 230, kind of historically. I mean, and that stuff never gets resolved. It just kind of continues on. And so now here we are in this new place with all those previous conflicts still sort of up in the air. And now we're adding this one, which essentially says companies shouldn't be able to regulate any of this stuff and leave it to the states to decide.
It comes down to like, who do you trust? Can you trust anybody, right? Because you're saying that you have to trust a big mega corporation that has done a bunch of not great stuff and has let a bunch of harmful stuff happen, you know, thinking about like all the disinformation that occurred on Facebook in the first Trump election and the second one, and all of this stuff. And then you're going to say, well, those are the guys who we're going to trust to make sure the harmful content doesn't remain on the platform. But at the same time, they do regulate quite a lot of harmful content. You can imagine what a world would look like where they didn't have that sword, as you put it. You know, it would be 4chan and 8chan. It would be all over the place if you didn't allow them some ability to regulate. So it kind of, like we said, leaves us both still at the end of this conversation. At least for me, I'm at the end of this conversation. Is like, I still don't know exactly how I feel.
Yeah. And even in the short term, when you are looking at these cases that are before the Supreme Court, one of the things that one of the lawyers for the tech companies said to the Supreme Court was, if these proposed state laws were allowed to stand, it would cause such disruptions and the social media platforms would become so gun shy and so worried about the kind of things they could be held liable for that they might only host content about puppies in the entire state of Florida. So every time you search for anything in Florida, all you get is puppies, which presumably is so inoffensive that nobody could hold these companies liable. Obviously, that was a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but it's the idea that this is how cautious these companies could be as a result of the law even standing a little bit in the short term, to say nothing about being upheld by the Supreme Court.
And maybe what all of this is this false dichotomy argument. You don't have to either wholly support 230 or wholly want to take it down, right? Perhaps the way forward is to make provisions like Section 230 more reflective of the modern times, with things like the algorithms that at times promote this harmful content because, as you pointed out earlier, it's the thing that gets the most clicks. It doesn't make sense necessarily to say that it's all bad or all good, because we also have, don't we have tools in the justice system to capture some of this nuance, to say, yes, it is good that we have these provisions, but at the same time, perhaps if a social media company is guilty of promoting content that could be considered harmful via their own proprietary algorithms, well, then they can be liable for prosecution.
There's a publication called the American Affairs Journal that posited an argument a couple of years ago around the what's called the common law standard of duty of care, which the American Affairs Journal says, quote, "Ordinarily, businesses have a common law duty to take reasonable steps to not cause harm to their customers, as well as to take reasonable steps to prevent harm to their customers. That duty also creates an affirmative obligation in certain circumstances for a business to prevent one party using the business's services from harming another party." Then I think this is the big takeaway. Platforms could potentially be held culpable under common law if they unreasonably created an unsafe environment, as well as if they unreasonably failed to prevent one user from harming another user or the public.
It's not that you need to just be protected wholesale from being able to do whatever the heck you want. To put the onus on being like responsible citizens, because there's a lot that's being talked about now with responsible digital citizenship, the responsible technology, all of that kind of stuff too. And of course, this is what the CDA tried to do, and that was 96. The internet's way different than 96, and no one saw any of this shit coming. So now that we are here, we can't be in these antiquated arguments that are just relying on these very one side versus the other arguments.
In theory, yes. I mean, as it stands now, the Supreme Court seems unlikely to uphold the Texas and Florida laws, which means we're back to square one in a sense. The Section 230 continues on as it has been. Tech companies go back to just being the bad guys that we have to then think about how to regulate. And, you know, as far as the upcoming election, you could say, well, if you want to build your opinion about what to think about it based on the two political candidates, well, guess what? Both Trump and Biden at one time or another came out against 230. Both of them said at one point or another, we want to repeal this thing. Biden has since said, maybe we should just amend it. But still, you can't look to the heads of the two major parties for any kind of clarity on it. And it comes down to, I guess, you know, what's the internet for? Why are we paying to come into this warehouse and see all of this crap, Stephen? And what kind of crap is going to be in there?
Because we were promised so much. And the internet, like I said before, gives so much, ask so little.
Yeah.
I feel like maybe I'm on the take from the internet.
Yeah. Stephen's very pro-internet.
I think we've said a lot of things tonight. I think we could all agree that the internet is great and flawless.
That's right, Stephen. It's certainly a place that could be full of delights or could be an empty sort of wasteland. And the decisions we make about how to regulate it or not will determine whether, you know, when you pay your entry fee and you go through the doors, it's a candy-coated playground of joy and delight, or something that, you know, has little cups of urine on a table somewhere.
And a single jelly bean.
Stephen, this has been Journos. I'm Brandon R. Reynolds.
And I am Stephen Jackson.
And check us out on social media. We're at Journos Pod at Instagram and TikTok, and on Substack at Journos.